Well, thank you, David. And I think I'm going to start today just by making a particular thank you, David, generally, for making this service available to so many of us, which so many people have found useful. I know you spend a great deal of time and effort doing it, and you don't always get a lot of appreciation, but we do appreciate it, and thanks. So, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our study of the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. My name is Doug Thompson, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. And as usual, I just want to start today's program with a reminder of why we have come together to share in the study of the words Jesus dictated to Helen and Bill. Jesus said, "Wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there also shall I be." And I not only believe that he said it, I believe he is here with us, and that's what makes this work. We are gathered in his name. Now, for those who are here for the first time, I'm going to provide a bit of a background to what we're doing, and those who are already familiar with this part can take a 5-minute break. As most of you know, the course exists in a number of versions. And as a result of extensive editing and abridgment over the years, there are a number of versions of the course because it was edited. And anyone looking at the earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that some parts certainly needed some editing. Some of the editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally much clearer. In fact, some of the most important teachings in the early part of the course simply vanished along the way. We don't know exactly how that happened. One reason for studying this material is that it gives us a clearer picture not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Helen and Bill, what he really meant. Some of us have found that added clarity of understanding to be useful. Now, the earliest written record of A Course in Miracles is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. Hardly a week passes that someone doesn't ask me about other versions of the course which are also advertised or labeled as in some way original. There are actually 6 different versions of the text of the course of which I'm aware, and 5 for which I've been able to obtain copies. Most of these have been published, and in most cases, the publisher claims each is in some way original. Inevitably, some confusion arises because of that. What we're working with today is original in the sense of being what was originally written down by Helen Schuckman before the editing process began. Now, what I've been doing for the past few months is going through the shorthand notes and identifying material which did not make it into the air text, and combining these two earliest and most original versions. The resulting document, then, is not any one of the 5 known scribal versions, but rather a combination of the 2 earliest ones. It includes essentially all of the, quote, original dictation, unquote, for which we have any documentary evidence. This material has some rough spots, some segments which were written down only in point form, and some sentences which were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need some editing in places, in that it's not a finished product. The notes also include some material specifically labeled as a private point and not part of the course. This includes conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen at the time. While not part of the course proper, these outtakes, if you will, or sidebars, provide considerable insight into Helen's experience and often involve explanations of miracle principles, practical examples from Helen's own life, and as such they can expand our understanding of both the course proper and the scribing experience which resulted in what we know of today as A Course in Miracles. So what we're going to be doing today will be a reading and some commentary and discussion of this combined document that combines the notes in the Urtext. And at this point, Deborah is going to post the link to that. So anybody who wants to follow along with us as we're reading can do so on the net. Last week we got as far as the end of section A in chapter 2, so we'll be starting today at T2B, which when that comes up on your screen, you'll be able to see on the sidebar on the left. And for those on the radio who can't see what's on the board, you can get to this document at www.miraclesinactionpress.com, DTHOMP74. In the screen that comes up, click on Original Dictation in the top left corner, and it will take you to the same place as that link Deborah just posted. Okay, so the basic format we're going to be doing is reading, discussion. If you want to make a comment or have a question, you can type it on the board or put your hand up. Deborah will be trying to monitor the hands. And when she gives you the, when she calls on you then and drops the mic, then you can pick it up. Please try to keep your comments focused on the topic and brief if possible, unless something really significant comes up, which occasionally it does. We'll let the Holy Spirit direct us there. Okay, now I'm hearing a very loud soundtrack coming from somewhere. I don't know what it is. I'm going to drop the mic. I'm done. Deborah, you can start your intro.
Well, very strange. It sounded like a toilet flushing from my end. Oh, it sounded like that to you, too. That's pretty funny. Okay, hi, everyone. I really miss Doug's opening line. Doug, if you're there, I miss the very opening lines because, well, I guess I got in here a minute after or looked in again. So I wanted to thank you, Dove, if you're still hanging in here. Thank you very much for this room and having us here in this time. Very much gratitude sent to you. Thank you very, very much. And to us all, to say internally, as per usual, help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today, if you will tell me what to do. Only that I will to do. And Lord, heal me. And actually, there's nothing else for me to say. If there's any questions anyone has before I begin reading, toss up your hand. And I see no hands. So what I'm going to do is begin reading. I'll save anything else that I have to say to anything that goes obscure and we need to fill the time. All right, here we go. So, T2B1 is where we're beginning. The reinterpretation of defenses. The atonement as defenses, which is in the FIP. When you are afraid of anything, you are acknowledging its power to hurt you. Remember that where your heart is, there is your treasure also. This means that you believe in what you value. If you are afraid, you are valuing wrong. Human understanding will inevitably value wrong, and by endowing all human thoughts with equal power, will inevitably destroy peace. This is why the Bible speaks of the peace of God which passeth, in parentheses, human understanding. Right now, Doug, hearing a loud musical background, there's a baby bird out in the bushes screaming for food. So that's the only thing I can hear. Other than that, there's no music on, unless it's coming from you, Doug. Must be. T1B2. This piece is totally incapable of being shaken by human errors of any kind. It denies the ability of anything which is not of God to affect you in any way. This is the proper use of denial. It is not used to hide anything, but it is used to correct error. It brings all error into the light, and since error and darkness are the same, it abolishes error automatically. I had some notes written down here. So fear when not in peace, we are in fear. So it's a real gauge there on whether we actually are in peace. If we're not feeling peace, we're in fear. Someplace we're in fear. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, I had a very strange experience there with music coming very loudly across my speakers from I know not where. You heard it the first time. Was that a toilet flush? So I've been fighting with... It's gone now. But there's a couple of things on these first two paragraphs which connect very much with what we were talking about last week. And the first idea is that you believe in what you value and you believe in what you create, whether it's illusory or not. So our beliefs and our values are essentially our choices. And there's a very key concept here that Deborah just mentioned. If you are afraid, you are valuing wrong. It means you have put the value somewhere. It means there's an illusion somewhere going on. And in T2B3, the proper use of denial is a very, very, very key concept too. It is not used to hide anything properly. The ego uses denial to hide the truth. And it does that because it's afraid of guilt, sin, and punishment, all of which are putting value on illusions. Guilt, sin, punishment, these are all illusory things. At least guilt and sin are. So the proper use of denial is used to correct error. And it is to deny that there's truth to what I'm afraid of, for instance. That would be the proper use of denial. If you're afraid, you are valuing wrong. If I believe that, then I know that when I experience fear, I have believed or valued mistakenly. And therefore, I can use denial to say, that's a mistake. So I'm denying value to the mistake. And that can actually eliminate the fear. Deny error in your own mind, yes, as a very, 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 very abstract way of putting it, in a much more concrete way of putting it, anything that makes you afraid has to have been resulted from a mistake. And therefore, you can deny value to the mistake. You can say, okay, that's got to have been wrong, so I don't have to be afraid of that. That has to be a mistaken perception. And that can cure it. So the peace, human understanding will inevitably value wrong if it's limited to human understanding. And by the time we get to chapter 3, that would be the understanding of the ego. The word ego hasn't shown up yet. And by endowing all human thoughts with equal power, human understanding will inevitably destroy peace. And that takes us to the first law of chaos, that every thought is of equal value, whether it's true or false. Essentially, that there is nothing true or false. Nothing can be really known. Nothing's really factual. It's all just fluff. That's human thought, such that, or human understanding, such that all thoughts have equal power. Whereas the true thoughts of God really do have power, and the false thoughts that we make up, our illusions, really don't, unless we give it to them. So human understanding will inevitably destroy peace, and that is why the Bible speaks of the peace of God which passeth understanding. We can't really understand, at the human level, what the peace of God is. But it's totally incapable of being shaken by human errors of any kind. It denies the ability of anything which is not of God to affect you in any way. And that's the proper use of denial. And that's what we're being taught here. The proper use of denial, which is to recognize that anything that's not of God can't really hurt us, doesn't really have power, and that if we're afraid, we're valuing something not of God or believing in it, so we can deny the truth of that which is false and therefore find peace. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about that one. Deborah.
Lee, you have your hand up, so here's the mic.
Well, Doug used the word concrete, so I just wanted to say that I have a very concrete example, which is exactly what I was writing about. I was sitting across the table from my mother today having lunch when she started saying projecting some pretty hurtful and vicious things towards me if someone were sitting there listening. And while she was speaking, from what I was hearing without, my mind from within recognized that nothing she was saying was true, nothing. And I was holding it up in comparison to what Jesus says about in the atonement, and only the truth is true about any soul that's emanating any body. And I'm listening to my mother. This is what he's talking about. Deny the denial of truth in my own mind. I didn't have to stand up and mow my mother down and flip the table, but I sat there, and so that was my concrete. I'll let go of the mic. I really love and appreciate this. Thank you.
Yeah, that would be an extraordinary, I think, exactly bang on example of what is being illustrated here, or what is being explained here in the Course. When you know it's not true, when you believe it's not true, then it doesn't have any power to move you. It's only in investing it with truth that it can come to fear. And you're absolutely right. When something not true is being said, just the recognition of that can deprive it of power to upset your peace in any way. That's a great example. Thank you for that. And this takes us to T2B4. Deborah, here you go.
I need to address that too for the experience, that the way that I connect with it, which really threw me off initially because of actually, I guess, thinking or experiencing it all in sort of a feeling of what the other person, if another person is saying untruth, coming from untruth, then they're going to be in a state of fear. The truth of them is in the state of love. But in hearing, in listening to them and opening to them, then that comes through me, and I feel that state of fear as in a way of interpreting what's happening to them. Then I recognize fear here, so there's untruth. And then it becomes that releasing from that and not getting tangled in that. So releasing from it and recognizing the truth is, do I have an investment of truth in those untruths myself, or does that just slip on through then and become the standing truth of who we both are? Does that make sense? I need to have some feedback on there, that because that... Okay, Lee, thank you. Okay, so if anybody else has anything to say, hand. If not, I'm going to carry on reading here. Okay.
You dropped the mic, Deborah.
Oops, thank you. I'll start the paragraph again. T2B4. What are you saying there, Lee? If I don't believe in the attack that my brother is attempting, he is being set free too. Right, no matter how he may be fighting it right. So just recognizing that that's what it is, and not reacting to that, letting it go, and then seeing the very truth, then that is also setting him free and giving him that space in order to see himself or to... It quickly washes through, doesn't it, Lee? It can just so quickly wash through for the person that is there in that moment. It's because I know when I've been there in that moment and someone is that open in their space with me, they're receiving me. I know they're understanding what I'm saying. They can recognize where I am, but they're not holding that to me, and they're releasing it, and boy, does that shift inside myself. That is so amazingly a powerful shifting device. Thanks for saying that. Okay, so I'm not touching my cursor, so I think I'm still plugged in. T2B4. True denial is a very powerful protective advice. You can and should deny any belief that error can hurt you. This kind of denial is not a concealment device, but a correction device. The right mind of the mentally healthy depends on it. You can do anything I ask. I have asked you to perform miracles and have made it very clear that these are natural, corrective, healing, and universal. There is nothing good they cannot do, but they cannot be performed in the spirit of doubt. Remember my own question before you ask yours, O ye of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt it? To Christ and the apostles, in parentheses, reference to Christ and the apostles walking on water.
Okay. I'm going to pick up the mic there. You can do anything I ask. I have asked you to perform miracles and have made it very clear that these are natural, corrective, healing, and universal. But they cannot be performed in a spirit of doubt. Now, that idea, I must say, has troubled me for decades. The contrast between faith and doubt. But what is being made clear here is that the doubt refers to this truth and falsehood idea that was being discussed in the previous paragraphs. I'm going to go back to T2B4. True denial. The proper use of denial, which is denying that which is false, is a very powerful protective device. You can and should deny any belief that error can hurt you. Now, that would really be doubt, the belief that error can hurt you. And if you believe that, then you can't do miracles. That's the connection I draw between these two paragraphs here. Not that one must have blind faith in things you don't actually believe, which is how I understood it for years. I thought, well, I just can't believe things I don't believe, so I guess I'm full of doubt and I don't have faith. No, I'm so lost. But I don't think that's what he's getting at in the context of doubt. I think it is that sense of being in the right mind. You must be in your right mind and believing the truth to perform miracles. And if you're not in your right mind and you believe that errors can hurt you or you're frightened, then the miracle will not work. And then the example from the gospel story of Jesus walking on the water in the storm, and the disciples are in the boat, and Peter steps out of the boat and starts walking on water himself. But then he looks at the waves and he experiences fear and he starts to sink. His miracle working capability is destroyed by his fear that the waves can hurt him or something might hurt him. And then the word doubt is used in the Bible. O ye of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? And that was in Matthew 8:26. So I think that's really important in terms of what's been happening here in chapter one, where first we're given the principles of miracles, and then we're given that detailed description of the many kinds of misperceptions that can distort miracle impulses into various kinds of idolatry or possession fallacies, where we start believing the false, and instead of having a miracle, we have some kind of mental illness. And that ultimately the illusions have to be denied in order for right-mindedness to prevail, and if not, what's happening is not going to be miracles. And this leads really nicely into T2B6, where Helen and Bill are presenting the question to Jesus, okay, how come we're having a hard time with this, incorporating what we're being taught into our own lives? And Jesus goes into a lengthy answer. Deborah, here is the microphone.
Okay, T2B6. You have asked yourselves why you cannot really incorporate my words, parentheses, the idea of cannibalism in connection with the sacrament is a reflection of a distorted view of sharing. I told you before that the word thirst in connection with the Spirit was used in the Bible because of the limited understanding of those to whom I spoke. I also told you not to use it. The same holds for expressions like feeding on. Symbiosis is understood by the mentally ill who use it that way. But I also told you that you must recognize your total dependence on God, a statement which you did not like. Close parenthesis. Doug.
Okay. That can sound a bit weird, cannibalism, sacrament. There is one critique of Christianity that the sacrament of Holy Communion or the Eucharist, this is take, you know, where you eat the biscuit and you drink the wine, and the biscuit is supposedly a representation of Jesus' flesh and the wine is said to be, this is my blood. Then it does sound like cannibalism to people who don't understand where it's coming from. And then the notions of thirst and feeding on, these physical metaphors, which Jesus then says, while they speak of symbiosis, it's misunderstood by the mentally ill who use it in that distorted way. But I also told you, you must recognize your total dependence on God, a statement you didn't like. But total dependence defines symbiosis. So there's a symbiosis, but it's not these metaphors of feeding on or thirst or eating the flesh of Jesus aren't, what's the word he uses? Well, if they're misunderstood, they lead us to misunderstand. Okay. Anyways. So. Yeah, during the first century, Christians were accused of cannibalism, and some critics of Christianity who don't know a lot about it do still look on the Eucharist as a grotesque, cannibalistic kind of undertaking. And on face value, if you just take a snapshot of it by itself, that is, in fact, what it looks like. Okay, Deborah, here's the mic.
T2B7. God and the souls he created are symbiotically related. They are completely dependent on each other. The creation of the soul itself has already been perfectly accomplished, but the creation by souls has not. God created souls so he could depend on them because he created them perfectly. He gave them his peace so they would not be shaken and would be unable to be deceived. Whenever you are afraid, you are deceived. Your mind is not serving your soul. This literally starves the soul by denying its daily bread. Remember the poem about the Holy Family which crossed your mind last night, where tricks of words are never said and mercy is a plan as bread. Read that again. Where tricks of words are never said and mercy is as plain as bread. Can't see through these glasses. The reason why they had such a strong impact on you originally was because you knew what it meant. God offers only mercy. Your own words should always reflect only mercy, because that is what you have received, and that is what you should give. Justice is a temporary expedient or an attempt to teach man the meaning of mercy. Its judgmental side rises only because man is capable of injustice, if that is what his mind creates. You are afraid of God's will because you have used your own will, which he created in the likeness of his own, to miscreate. What you do not realize is that the mind can miscreate only when it is not free. An imprisoned mind is not free by definition. It is possessed or held back by itself. Its will is therefore limited and not free to assert itself. Doug.
Okay, this refers back to what we were discussing last week about the difference between tyranny and authority. That authority is Christ's guidance. Tyranny is any kind of fantasy, illusion, or possession. So miscreation can only occur when the mind is not free or under tyrannous authority, the authority of our illusions, the belief that something not true can hurt us, for instance. So in a prison mind is obviously in prison. It's not free. It's possessed or held back or limited by itself, by its having accepted to believe or value a lie. And its will is therefore limited by falsehood. It can't really be what it really is, which is God's creation. And it can't really be in communion with God because it has created this, by believing in the falsehood, it has erected a barrier to the truth. And this all comes in answer to Helen's question, why she and Bill cannot really incorporate these words back in T2B6. Okay, this takes us to T2B10. Deborah.
The three things that crossed your mind, which was comparatively free at the time, are perfectly relevant. One, it is all right to remember the past, provided you also remember that anything you suffer is because of your own errors. Two, in this context, your remark that after the burning, I swore if I ever saw him again, I would, not was written in later, recognize him. Note, by the way, that you did not put in the not until afterwards. That is because your inherent correction device was working properly at the moment. The result is that you are not denying me. Three, the story about Hinda. This was an excellent example of misperception, which led to a totally unwarranted fear of a person. in parenthesis, or open parenthesis, Helen Schuckman's story refers to a very young child who fell down the stairs when Helen Schuckman had arms open in a welcoming gesture at bottom of stairs. For years afterwards, Hinda screamed upon seeing Helen Schuckman, close parenthesis. The misstep which caused her fall had nothing at all to do with you, just as your own missteps have nothing at all to do with me. Doug.
I just wanted to point out for those who may not have already noticed that when things are in parentheses, they usually pertain to, the reason Helen puts in the bracket is usually because she's putting in a comment of her own. And they're often in point form and bad grammar, as this one is. It's sort of an explanatory note about who Hinda was, which Helen knew, but no other reader would know, or a few other readers would know. So that would be Helen speaking to us there, explaining the reference to Hinda, or at least as she understood it. And also, I don't think we're going to run into any today, but if you see something in bold italic, that means it's material from the notes that is not in the ear text. Otherwise, this material is essentially ear text. And we're going to, if those who are following along will also see the T2B14 denial of errors, defense of truth in blue, that refers to labeling of the unlabeled sections that I added. Okay, that's my own insertion to help organize this material. As everybody probably knows, most of the text is divided into chapters and sections, with section labels when the topic changes, which are quite useful for navigating through the work. In the ER text, a vast amount of chapters 1 and 2 never made it into the subsequent Hugh Lane Casey version. And the chapter and section breaks, there are no chapter and section breaks in the ER text or the notes. In this document and most editions of the ER text that you'll see, the HLC chapter and section breaks have essentially been retrofitted to the same spot. But that leaves some huge sections in Chapter 1 which have no section breaks, where the topic changes and shifts. So that's why I've inserted these topic labels where there is a change in topic. And they're simply there for navigational convenience, and if you don't like them, ignore them. okay, so this takes us to T2B14. And the denial of error in the defense of truth, which we've already had some reference to. Deborah.
Denial of error is a very powerful defense of truth. We have slowly been shifting the emphasis from the negative to the positive use of denial. Remember, we have already stated that denial is not a purely negative device. It results in positive miscreation. That is the way the mentally ill do employ it. Doug.
Okay, the word denial has shown up a great deal in Chapter 1 in terms of ego defense mechanisms, ego denying truth. It's a well-known psychological concept. And Jesus is taking that concept and now essentially flipping it on its head and showing it how the same kind of mechanism can be used in a very positive way by a sane mind to deny reality to that which is insane, in essence, to deny the validity of an error or the power of an error to hurt us. Okay, Deborah.
But remember a very early thought of your own. Never underestimate the power of denial. In the service of the right mind, the denial of error frees the mind and reestablishes the freedom of the will. When the will is really free, it cannot miscreate because it recognizes only truth. Projection arises out of false denial, not out of its proper use. My own role in the atonement is one of true projection, i.e., I can project to you the affirmation of truth. If you project error to me, in parentheses, or to yourself, you are interfering with the process. My use of projection, which can also be yours, is not based on faulty denial, but it does involve the very powerful use of the denial of error. Doug.
Okay, I just, again, a reminder to what we discussed in the last couple of weeks about projection and extension. And how before the material was edited, projection can mean two things, and in this paragraph it does. In T2B16, projection arises out of false denial. That would be the misuse of projection. That's projecting guilt. Then there's a proper kind of projection, which was later edited usually to extension. Two very closely related terms that are used in the dictionary to define each other. But in the original writing, it's all projection. But projection doesn't always mean what the ego does with guilt. It also means what the Holy Spirit or Jesus or the right mind does with truth. It extends it. It affirms it. So projection, in case anybody is unclear, projection can mean either in this document, and one has to look at the context to determine which kind of projection, the holy kind or the unholy kind, is being referred to. So the proper use of projection is described by Jesus here. My own role in the atonement, which has been defined as undoing, is one of true projection. In effect, I can project to you the affirmation of truth, or extend to you the affirmation of truth, which is atonement because it undoes the misperception of truth or the perception of falsehood. But if you project error, and that would be the improper use of projection to me or to yourself, you are interfering with that process. And then my use of projection, which can also be yours, is not based on faulty denial, but does involve the very powerful use of denial of error. Okay. And Deborah has just posted the link again. For those on the radio who may not be able to see the board, of course you can't see the board if you're on the radio, and you want to follow along with this document online, go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74, and then in the top left corner of what pops up, click on original dictation. It will take you to this document. Each paragraph is labeled, and we're on paragraph T2B17. And if you want to search for that in your internet browser, hit Control F, and then T space 2 space B space 17, and you'll go right to it. Deborah.
And for station identification, I don't know if this, people have to know that it's in this room to give a station given a station identification, I don't know if that's just redundant, that people know that immediately if they're listening, or if this is streamed through a place on the internet that doesn't necessarily identify the source. So for station identification here, this is happening at ACIM Gather in Peltock Scene, where you can attend in person in live sessions or listen by radio. So can somebody answer my question there so that I know for another time to do station identification or not? I'll let the mic go.
Well, it is possible that there are people listening on the radio who don't actually know that if they loaded Paltalk software, which they can get for free, they could join in the conversation and see the board. So I don't think it hurts to make a short announcement to that effect. I don't know, maybe somebody has something else to add to that, but I don't see that it could hurt. Okay. Deborah.
Thank you, Doug. We are starting here at T2B17. We're commencing. The miracle worker is one who accepts my kind of denial and projection, unites his own inherent abilities to deny and project with mine, and imposes them back on himself and others. This establishes the total lack of threat anywhere. Together we can then work for the real time of peace, which is eternal. Notice I got the word eternal, not external. I inspired Bob, in parentheses, referring to elevator man who took Helen Schuckman down from her apartment, close parenthesis, to make that remark to you, and it is a pity that you heard only the last part. But you can still use that. His remark ended with, every shut eye is not asleep. Since your own version is much improved at the moment, we will go on a while. T2B19, Freud and Defense Mechanism. Doug.
I just wanted to comment that that paragraph is one of those personal remarks and that Jesus is making to Helen about an event in her own experience from which I don't extract much sense. But I do find it really insignificant that what's happening there, that he's telling Helen that a comment that the elevator operator made to her recently was inspired by himself. And that's a very important kind of idea. If the elevator operator or taxi driver is being inspired by Jesus to tell me things that I'm not getting direct, then I should pay attention to comments that I hear from anybody and everybody because maybe they were inspired by Jesus. Now, in Helen's case, she's taking down pages of direct dictation from Jesus every day. You would think that of all people, she'd be the last on earth that Jesus would have to use an elevator operator to get to her, yet he does. Which is interesting to me. very interesting. Deborah. Okay, we're at T2B19 where we move into the discussion of Freud's notion of ego defenses. Some of this gets a bit technical, and if there's any problems or difficulties people have, type a question on the board or throw up your hand, and I'll do my best to help explain it. Deborah.
You know what? I've been sitting with this T2B16. Before we go on with Freud stuff, I just wanted to back up again there. Christian has reposted the paragraph on the board, and it's just one of those incredibly important paragraphs. It's for us as miracle workers. It's something that for us to really pay attention to, so that we actually do get it right and realize the power of projection. Of both ways that we can use projection. So I just want to read it again. Thanks, Christian, for posting it there. T2B16, projection arises out of false denial. No, I'm on the wrong paragraph. The one I wanted. Just a second here. The one I wanted was the one Christian has there, the miracle worker. So it's T2B17. So both are super important, but I already pointed out the other one. So T2B17, the miracle worker is one who accepts my kind of denial and projection, unites his own inherent abilities to deny and project with mine, and imposes them back on himself and others. So he's in real right mind with Jesus. This establishes the total lack of threat anywhere. Together we can then work for the real time of peace, which is eternal. Real amazing. And now, okay, there we go. I'm going to go on to our fair friend Freud here, Freud and defense mechanisms. T2B19, Freud's identification of defense mechanisms was quite correct, as was his recognition of their creative ability. They can indeed create man's perception, both as himself and his surroundings. But Freud's limitations induced inevitable limits on his own perception. He made two kinds of errors. Before I go into those, Doug, here's the mic.
I just wanted to draw attention to that last sentence in T2B19. I'm going to read the whole thing again. I think it's a really crucial concept. Freud's identification of defense mechanisms was quite correct, as was his recognition of their creative ability. They can indeed create man's perception, both of himself and his surroundings. This relates to that famous line, projection creates perception. What we project, whether it be false denial or true denial, whether it be belief in the false and fear, or belief in the truth and peace, creates our perceptions of ourselves and our surroundings. Projections create perceptions. Yes, that quote actually occurs twice in the course, one in chapter 12, one in chapter 21. In chapter 21, it's followed by a paragraph of explanation, which basically says, to paraphrase and summarize, if you project fear, you're going to experience and perceive a fearful world. If you project love, you're going to experience and perceive a loving world. Those are the two worlds that Jesus is contrasting frequently. One is created by the false use of denial, and valuing that which is false, hiding from the truth. And Freud's idea of defense mechanisms is how we defend ourselves against the truth, basically. And the correct use of projection is to extend love or truth with Jesus as guided. And that is the miracle. And that results in the real world, which is characterized by the solution to every problem. Peace, joy, love, harmony, and indeed the gate of heaven. So this is the real stuff of miracle-mindedness. The use of projection and denial to sift the true from the false under the authority of guidance, so as to avoid the tyranny of deception or illusion or fantasy. And under authority, we are free to be who we really are. Under tyranny, we create a false self and a false world, in essence. We believe we're something we're not, and we perceive around us a world that's full of fear and terror and danger and bad things that are really only in our own mind. Deborah.
I just realized that my volume on the board was turned way down. Does this make a difference? Can you guys hear me louder now than what you were hearing me previously? Better? Okay, so I'm hoping that it was picked up on the mic, okay, Doug, because it was really low. And it sounded, you sounded so much louder when I turned it up. So here I can go and to continue reading here. I'll start again at T2B20. But Freud's limitations induced inevitable limits on his own perception. He made two kinds of errors. The first is that he saw only how the mechanisms worked in the mentally ill. The second is his own denial of the mechanism of the atonement. Okay, thanks, Doug. Let us take up the first, because a clear understanding of the second depends on it. Denial should be directed only to error, and projection should be limited to truth. Denial should be directed only to error, and projection should be limited to truth. You should truly give as you have truly received. The golden rule can work effectively only on this basis. Intellectualization is a poor word which stems from the brain-mind confusion. Right-mindedness is better. This device defends the right mind and gives it control over the body. Intellectualization implies a split, whereas right-mindedness involves healing. Withdrawal is properly employed in the service of withdrawing from the desert. It is not a device for escape, but for consolidation. There is only one mind. Dissociation is quite similar. You should split error off from error, but only in defense of integration. Doug.
A lot of these terms here are technical terms which would have been much more meaningful to Helen than they would be for an average audience. But I want to look at T2B26. Withdrawal is properly employed in the service of withdrawing from the desert, which should have a footnote referring it to a previous, I believe it's previous comment, but the only thing to do with a desert is to leave. A desert is lifeless, and the only thing you can do is leave. And this relates to the proper use of denial. If a false idea occurs to you, dismiss it. Absolutely dismiss it. The way the ego's defenses can dismiss the truth by just avoiding to look at it. The proper use of denial is very effective. There's no point entertaining a false idea. There's no point sitting around in the desert trying to figure out what to do. What you need to do is withdraw from it. Leave. So withdrawal would be one expression of denial, withdrawing attention from falsehood, withdrawing attention from falsehood, withdrawing involvement with that which is false. Simply use denial. It's not true. I don't need to pay attention to it. I can put it out of my mind and replace that space in my mind with the truth. So it's not escape, but consolidation, because there is only one mind. Now, what does that mean? That means that you're consolidating with the truth, which is God, which is the one mind, and you are achieving oneness in that effort. Whereas if you fiddle about with the desert or the falsehood, you're introducing a split. You're splitting yourself off from the truth. You're entertaining the possibility that there is something other than truth and the one mind. Dissociation, I don't know if how many people understand what that word actually means in psychiatric jargon, but it's similar to withdrawal. It's a more extreme form of not paying attention to what's going on. Splitting away from error, but in defense of integration of self with God. Again, integration being unification, recognition that we are all one. Only deny error and extend love. So deny error and extend love. Yes. That's definitely what he's saying here. Deborah, here's the mic.
It's sort of a clarity on old psychology where it gives falsehood all the attention. So people just sit in problems repeatedly, round and round and round and round and round. It never gets off of that treadmill of error having the attention or the falsehood having the attention. So the new model would be to recognize you are of the truth, the source is inside you. Somehow you're blocking that out. So it would be to identify the blockage, that there is a blockage there, maybe possibly ask into it, what am I trying to do by this, by doing this? What is it I'm trying to do? A lot of times just identifying the blockage, that there is a blockage there, and giving it some kind of a voice. The falsehood just kind of shows up, and that truth is able to just come through it and wash it away. A transformation takes place. So I just wanted to add that in there. Doug, here's the mic.
Yes, absolutely, Deborah. Absolutely. That is so right on. And that refers back to T2B21. The first of Freud's errors is that he saw only how the mechanisms worked in the mentally ill, which is a common scientific criticism of a lot of psychology, that all it does is study sick people. How do you learn how to be healthy from studying sickness? As if somehow health was simply an absence of sickness or symptoms. And Freud didn't understand that these mechanisms, defense mechanisms, operate in everybody. And only in extreme cases do those people present in a psychiatrist's office as mentally ill. And Freud was only willing to recognize that these things were relevant to his patients. He wasn't willing to recognize that they were relevant to himself and his colleagues and everybody else as well. Deborah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add to the bit of thought that I was saying there about in the process of allowing that to transform or turning that around, as Deborah has posted. Then look, just even asking into it, what is it I'm trying to do? Because it is always a there's always a positive function to it. Always. There can't be anything but a positive function to it, because at any given time, we're trying to get love or we're trying to give love. So love is involved. So there's always that positive function to reconnect to our source, reconnect with love. So it becomes a turning around. It becomes a transformation and a release. So if there's anyone else has anything else to add in here, raise your hand. You've got the mic. If not, I'll continue reading here. So T2B28, detachment is essentially a weaker form of dissociation. This is one of the major areas of withholding that both you and Bill are engaging in. Flight can be undertaken in whatever direction you choose, but note that the concept itself implies flight from something. Flight from error is perfectly appropriate. Distanciation, in a way of putting distance between yourself and what you should fly from. That is, distanciation is a way of putting distance between yourself and what you should fly from. Regression is a real effort to return to your own original state. In this sense, it is utilized to restore, not to go back to the less mature. When I read this over earlier, I was sort of hanging with the word regression, and there's a lot of regression that goes on with people that are doing regression work. When I was reflecting on some regression work that I had done within myself, and it really wasn't taking me into a place of restoration. It was, I guess there was releases that happened, but it sort of just caught me in the, maybe it was the way I was guided to, the going from step to step. It sort of had me just paying attention of the stories that happened before. It really didn't take me to a place behind that or underneath that to help bring through that real truth, the real meat, and to just bring myself up to date and to allow all of those past illusions to release. Doug?
Okay, I think you're understanding the word regression there in terms of past life regression therapy, which is not how Freud understood it. He was talking about the tendency of some mentally ill people to regress to an earlier stage of development, such that an adult will act like a child and a 10-year-old will act like a 5-year-old in an effort to really avoid dealing with the life situation that the older person is finding himself with. He's trying to move to a, return to the womb kind of thing, or return to an earlier, simpler time. This would not, I don't think Freud never ever talked about past life regression therapy. So regression is a real effort to return to your original state, which is a state of oneness with God. In this sense, it is utilized to restore or undo or atone for the fall, the separation illusion that led us away from awareness of our original unity with God and each other, rather than Freud's idea of going back to the less mature. And in the next paragraph, sublimation is a term Freud coined to refer to people redirecting libido or sexual energy into creative endeavors, or even sometimes obsessive behavior, like the workaholic, sublimating his sexual drive into some other kind of drive. And Jesus is telling us here in T2B32 that it should be associated with the sublime. So he's basically taking Freud's terminology of defense mechanisms and putting a new spin on them, and leading us to look at them in different ways. Of course, if we're not familiar with Freud's terminology and ego defense structure, this probably wouldn't be terribly meaningful. Anyway, Deborah, I've already read 32, so sublimation should be associated with the sublime. So that takes us to T2B33. Here's the mic.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, Doug. My intent wasn't to confuse, but I do have this habit of just broadening it, not just staying with the select boundaries structure that is being talked about. So that my childhood is a past life to me, is my past. It's already over with. It's gone. Or I could go earlier than that into that time beforehand. So I was kind of jumped into that when I was going through it in my own mind. To me, it's sort of all the same thing, so hopefully I didn't put a confusion out there of what was actually being said here in the writing. So we will go to T2B33. There are many other so-called dynamic concepts which are profound errors due essentially to the misuse of defenses. Among them is the concept of different levels of aspiration, which results from real level confusion. However, the main point to be understood from these notes is that you can defend truth as well as error, and in fact, much better. Ha! Isn't that wonderful? We can defend truth much better. However, the main point to be understood from these notes is that you can defend truth as well as error, and in fact, much better. Doug.
Well, you already said what I was going to say, just to underscore that, that if there's any doubt about what point Jesus is making here, he's cleared it up in this concluding paragraph sentence to this segment, which addresses Freud's structure or theory of defense mechanisms, which is all about defending error and how mentally ill people make mistakes, misperceive, and then fortify those errors with various kinds of defenses so the truth can't get through. And he's pointing out that the same kind of psychodynamics can work exactly the opposite way to defend truth, and that needs to be done. Full stop. And this takes us into the next segment, a short segment about means and ends. T2B35. Deborah.
So far we have concentrated on ends rather than means because unless you regard an end as worth achieving, you will not devote yourself to the means by which it can be achieved. Your own question enabled me to shift the emphasis from end to means. In parentheses, question asked was, how can we incorporate this material? You and Bill have accepted the end as valuable, thus signifying your willingness to use defenses to ensure it. The means are easier to clarify after the true worth of the goal itself is firmly established. Everyone defends his own treasure. You do not have to tell him to do this because he will do so automatically. The real question still remains, what do you treasure and how much do you treasure it? Doug.
And of course, this refers back to the several previous comments that we've discussed in other weeks as well as earlier today, about you believe in what you create because you created it, and if you value that which is false, you will defend it. So what do you treasure, and how much do you treasure it? And of course, the implication there is that the truth, authority, should be treasured rather than tyranny, but we tend to be drawn to or distracted into tyranny, and thus we end up not very miracle-minded and not experiencing miracles. Deborah.
Once you learn to consider these two points and bring them into all your actions as the true criteria for behavior, I will have little difficulty in clarifying the means. You have not learned to be consistent about this as yet. I have therefore concentrated on showing you that the means are available whenever you do ask. You can save a lot of time, however, if you do not need to extend this step unduly. The correct focus will shorten it immeasurably. Doug.
Later in the course, as people familiar with it will know, Jesus asks us frequently to ask ourselves, what is it for? And particularly in chapter 30 in the Seven Rules for Decision, first you decide what you want to achieve. You decide on the ends. When you're clear on the ends, then the means fall into place. So correct behavior, which is another emphasis that we find in chapter 1, depends on this clarification of true ends under Christ's guidance and authority, as opposed to the mistaken end that most of us spend a lot of time wasting with, which are really the attempt to make an illusion true and using defenses to hide from the truth and make the illusion seem true, rather than defending truth against the illusions through the use of denial, simply denying that the false is true. And then he says a very interesting thing, which is, as anyone who's been paying attention to these two chapters will know, I have therefore concentrated on showing you that the means are available whenever you do ask. And this links into the whole idea of authority, which is defined as Christ's guidance, and the repeated emphasis Jesus places on asking him. What miracles do you want me to do today? Don't go running off on your own just because you think it's a good idea. And on, again and again, he uses this word ask and emphasizes that we all must ask and that we all can hear, even the guy in the elevator. And that when asked, Helen and Bill have been experiencing that Jesus provides the means in miraculous ways, in the smallest details of their lives, as well as the dictation of the Course and major psycho-spiritual issues they're dealing with. When they are clear and between the two of them agreed on the end and ask Jesus, the means are suddenly in front of them. Again and again, in the experience that these two have working through the materials this far, and they've only been at it a couple of months now, Jesus has been concentrated on showing them that the means are available whenever you do ask, and implied in that, though not stated, but you must ask. He does say that a couple of times elsewhere. He doesn't say it here. But it's really, really, really an important theme. And most of that ended up getting edited out. There's still a bit in there. You can still pick it up if you're looking for it in the shorter versions. But the repetitive emphasis combined with examples of how Jesus actually provides the means when the will is set, the choice has been made correctly, falsehood has been denied, truth has been embraced, the miracles flow. And if there's anything that can be extracted from this material that I think is relevant to everybody, certainly relevant to me, it's that I've got to ask and I've got to not use denial against truth and not set up my own illusions as my authority, because that becomes tyranny, and then my will is imprisoned, then I cannot be who I am. And then Jesus goes on to make another interesting point in T2B39. Deborah.
Okay, I was thinking I had read that one. You can save a lot of time. However, if you do not need to extend this step unduly, the correct focus will shorten it immeasurably. Papers will be very easy to write as this time is shortened. And I want to post the link again. We're starting in here at, we're commencing here at T2B41, the Atonement Defense. The atonement is the only defense which cannot be used destructively. That is because while everyone must eventually join it, it was not a device which was generated by man. The atonement principle was in effect long before the atonement itself was begun. The principle was love, and the atonement itself was an act of love. Acts were not necessary before the separation because the time-space belief did not exist. Doug.
Okay, well, I want to correct myself. I misspoke a moment ago that they've been at this for several months already. And I see from footnote 227, this is dated November 13th, The dictation began on October 21st, so they have been at it 3 or 4 weeks only at this point. They're just not quite at the 1 month point, and Jesus has been demonstrating to them powerfully this issue of means and ends. So I think that's all the more remarkable, that how much has been accomplished in such a short time. So the atonement is the only defense which cannot be used destructively. It was not generated by man, and the principle is love. And the atonement itself is an act of love. And then this very interesting line, acts were not necessary before the separation because the space-time belief did not exist before the separation. Notice space-time belief. It doesn't say space-time did not exist. He says the space-time belief did not exist, which I find quite interesting in terms of understanding what he means by, well, time-space. Space-time, same thing, I think. Okay. Deborah.
T2B 42. It was only after the separation that the defense of atonement and the necessary conditions for its fulfillment were planned. It became increasingly apparent that all of the defenses which man can choose to use constructively or destructively were not enough to save him. It was therefore decided that he needed a defense which was so splendid that he could not misuse it, although he could refuse it. His will could not turn it into a weapon of attack, which is the inherent characteristic of all other defenses. The atonement thus becomes the only defense which was not a two-edged sword. The atonement actually began long before the crucifixion. Many souls offered their efforts on behalf of the separated ones, but they could not withstand the strength of the attack and had to be brought back. Angels came, too, but their protection was not enough because the separated ones were not interested in peace. They had already split themselves and were bent on dividing rather than reintegrating. The levels they introduced into themselves turned against each other, and they, in turn, turned against each other. They established differences, divisions, cleavages, dispersion, and all the other concepts related to the increasing splits they produced. Not being in their right minds, they turned their defenses from protection to assault and acted literally insanely. It was essential to introduce a split-proof device which could be used only to heal, and it was used if it was used at all. Doug.
Well, I'm just looking at the comments on the board. Heaven Song, I believe, is Lee. And, yeah, a savior was not wanted. That's what we're being told here, that and, you know, if you think about insanity, a truly insane person will often resist any kind of treatment, any kind of help. He's completely convinced his insanity is sane. And can make it extraordinarily difficult to actually help him in any way at all. And what we have here is basically a short history of the atonement and the separation and how the separation made the defense of atonement necessary because all these other things, helpful souls and angels, were unable to overcome the power of the attack on self, in essence, that the separation developed in the mind of man. So, Deborah.
Did I? Oh, darn, I've missed my place. Let me see, read that. Okay, I'm into T2B45. The atonement was built into the space-time belief in order to set a limit on the need for the belief and ultimately to make learning complete. The atonement is the final lesson. Learning itself, like the classroom in which it occurs, is temporary. Let all those who overestimate human intelligence remember this. Parentheses, Helen Schuckman questions last sentence, which she perceives as threatening. Close parentheses. The ability to learn has no value when change or understanding is no longer necessary. The eternally creative have nothing to learn. Only after the separation was it necessary to direct the creative force to learning, because change behavior had become mandatory. Human beings can learn to improve their behavior and can also learn to become better and better learners. This increase serves, in parentheses, Helen Schuckman notes that this was written, served, to bring them in closer and closer accord with the sonship. But the sonship itself is a perfect creation, and perfection is not a matter of degree. Only while there are different degrees is learning meaningful. The evolution of man is merely a process by which the proceeds from one degree to the next. He corrects his previous missteps by stepping forward. This represents a process which is actually incomprehensible in temporal terms, because he returns as he progresses. In parentheses, originally was goes forward rather than progressives. Progresses, close parentheses. Doug.
Some amazing stuff here. some amazing stuff. Helen's finding some of this threatening, and having some difficulty taking it down, and she's making notes about this, as she's going. But it's really interesting here that the ability to learn has no value when a change of understanding is no longer necessary, and, the sonship is a perfect creation. This refers back to the soul need not learn anything, but the ego must. Actually, that's not referring back, that's referring forward. This idea will be picked up again, I think it's in chapter 3, where considerably more detail is gone into. But having separated ourselves, we have to learn to get back to where we were, where we don't need to learn. And in the end of T2B46, this represents a process which is actually incomprehensible in temporal terms, because he returns as he progresses. I have a vision in my mind of somebody falling from a hilltop down into a valley and having to progress up the hill to undo or atone for his fall, such that he returns as he progresses, but really he's regressing because he's going back where he came from. But since he didn't want to fall, he wanted to stay at the top of the hill, the whole trip downhill was a descent into error, if you will, a mistaken event which has to be undone or atoned for, and he has to learn how to climb a mountain, which he wouldn't have to learn how to do if he hadn't fallen off the mountain in the first place. So once he gets back to the mountain, he doesn't need to learn how to climb the mountain anymore. Anyways. That's how I'm understanding that one. If anybody else has a comment they want to make or an observation, do feel free. Deborah.
What does Y mean, Christian? I see parentheses with a Y in it. I would take that as a yes, but I guess not. So I don't see your hand. So I will continue on reading here. T2B 47. The atonement is a device by which he can free himself from the past as he goes ahead. It undoes his past errors, thus making it unnecessary for him to keep retracing his steps without advancing toward his return. In this sense, the atonement saves time, but like the miracle which serves it, does not abolish it. As long as there is a need for atonement, there is a need for time. But the atonement, as a completed plan, does not have a unique relationship to time. Until the atonement is finished, its various phases will proceed in time, but the whole atonement stands at its end. At this point, the bridge of the return has been built. Didn't hear the words, saw it in mind, Doug. Oh, for the image and communication of the image to me. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, bridge. That word will be used later to define the real world as a bridge to heaven or a gate to heaven. Various metaphors are used here. The notion of time being unreal is very significant in the overall theology of the Course. And here we're being told quite a bit about the purpose of time or the belief in time. Time is there to give us a space in which we can undo or atone for the mistake. Once it's done, time has no further purpose, like the classroom. Once you've passed all the tests and graduated from the course, the classroom is gone. It serves its purpose for a time, for a learning need, and then it is no more. So the atonement proceeds in time, but the whole of the atonement, or the completed atonement, the complete undoing of the separation illusion, stands at its end. And at that point, the bridge of the return has been built. We cross it. Time ceases to seem to exist. And that brings us to the end of that segment. We still have 28 minutes. And we have a personal bit here to Helen about her demon lover, and I think we have time to read that. Deborah, here you go. I don't think I'm going to have a whole lot of comments to make on this one, but others might. Deborah.
And hi, Carmen. T2B 49. Personal asides, Helen's fear of atonement and the demon lover. I guess that's all in parentheses. Parentheses. Note to Helen Schuckman, the reason this is upsetting you is because the atonement is a total commitment. You still think this is associated with loss. This is the same mistake all the separated ones make, in one way or another. They cannot believe that a defense which cannot attack also is the best defense. Except for this misperception, the angels could have helped them. What do you think the meek shall inherit the earth means? They will literally take it over because of their strength. A two-way defense is inherently weak precisely because it has two edges. It can turn against the self very unexpectedly. This tendency cannot be controlled except by miracles. Close parentheses. The miracle turns the defense of atonement to the protection of the inner self, which, as it becomes more and more secure, assumes its natural talent of protecting others. The inner self known itself as both a brother and a son. The inner self knows itself as both a brother and a son. Parentheses. The above notes were taken with great difficulty by Helen Schuckman and constitute the only series thus far that were written very slowly. When Helen Schuckman asked about this, she was told, "Don't worry about the notes. They are right, but you are not sufficiently right-minded yet to write about the atonement with comfort. You will write about it yet with joy." Close parenthesis. T2B52. Parenthesis. Aside from Helen Schuckman, last night I felt briefly but intensely depressed temporarily, under the impression that I was abandoned. I tried but couldn't get through it all. After a while, I decided to give up for the time being, and he said, "Don't worry, I will never leave you or forsake you." I did feel a little better and decided I was really not sick, so I could return to my exercises. While I was exercising, I had some part vision experiences which I found only mildly frightening at times and quite reassuring at others. I am not too sure about the sequence, but it began with a very clear assurance of love and an equally clear emphasis on my own great value, beauty, and purity. Things got a little confusing after that. First, the idea of Bride of Christ occurred to me with vaguely inappropriate undertones. Then there was a repetition of the Way of Love and a restatement of an earlier experience. Now, if it were from him to me, I mean, as if, now, let me read that again. Then there was a repetition of the Way of Love and a restatement of an earlier experience, now as if it were from him to me. Behold the handmaid of the Lord. Be it done unto you according to his word. Parentheses. This threw me into panic before, but at that time it was stated in a more accurate biblical phrasing. Be it done unto me accordingly to his word. Close parenthesis. This time I was a bit uneasy, but remembered I had misperceived it last time and was probably still not seeing it right. Actually, it is really just a statement of allegiance to the divine service, which can hardly be dangerous. Then there was a strange sequence in which Christ seemed to be making very obvious advances, which became quite sexual in my perception of them. I almost thought briefly that he turned into a devil. I got just a little scared, and the possession idea came in for a while, but I thought it so silly that there is no point in taking it seriously. Parentheses, as I am writing this, I remember that thing in the book about the demon lover, which one once threw me. In parentheses, note spelling through. It's spelled as T-H-R-O-U-G-H. which once threw me into a fit. I am upset, but the spelling slip is reassuring. Oh, the note spelling through was used in as T-H-R-E-W in there. I am upset, but the spelling slip is reassuring. This morning, we reviewed the whole episode. He said he was very pleased at the comparative lack of fear and also the commitment awareness that it was misperception. This showed much greater strength and a much increased right-mindedness. This is because defenses are now being used much better on behalf of truth more than error, though not completely so. The weaker use of misprojection is shown by my recognition that it can really be that way, which became possible as soon as denial was applied against error, not truth. This permitted a much greater awareness of alternative interpretations. It was also explained, the shift to the passive form instead of he also explained should be noted. This is an expression of fear, Remember the section in Letters from the Scattered Brotherhood you read last evening about hold fast and please do so, In parentheses, note made on 11/15 by Helen Schuckman regarding Bill's remark concerning top of page 5. Yes, but I doubt if it says this is inevitable. It may entail more miswill than we think. The above may have been too passively interpreted. Note that Bill did not ask my will regarding same. If he had, he would have felt better. Doug.
Okay. Well, that is... one of those... I mean, this is basically an excerpt from Helen's diary. In which he's recounting an experience. This is not dictation of the course. And she's dealing with some of her fears about the atonement. It begins with Jesus telling her, the reason this is upsetting you is because the atonement is a total commitment. You still think it is associated with loss. This is the same mistake all the separated ones make in one way or another, which would probably refer to most of us. They cannot believe that a defense which cannot attack is also the best defense. Except for this misperception, the angels could have helped them. Because the angels, of course, are offering simply atonement, undoing, not attacking the perceived threat. And the perception... the human perception or the ego perception tends to be that if I fear it, it must be a villain and I must be a victim. And the way to deal with a villain for a victim is to reverse the roles so that I become the villain and you become the victim if I think you're the villain to start with. And the result is war that does nobody any good. Undoing the misperception of villainy and victimhood is the healing, but the ego doesn't like that because the ego likes being a victim or likes to believe that there's a villain somewhere. So what do you think the meek shall inherit the earth means? They will literally take it over because of their strength. A two-way defense is inherently weak precisely because it has two edges. It can turn against the self very unexpectedly. And this tendency cannot be controlled except by miracles, and miracles are not available to those who are under the power of the tyranny of illusions. So the angels can't help them. Now, the second paragraph is also dictation. The miracle turns the defense of atonement to the protection of the inner self, which, as it becomes more and more secure, assumes its natural talent of protecting others. The inner self knows itself as both a brother and a son. That is a really interesting line. The inner self, the true self, the reality that we are, knows that we are both a brother of all humans, and it may not be restricted to humans, and a son of the Father. So naturally, to protect self is to protect brother. Then we get into Helen's difficulty and experience of something quasi-revelatory, which was confusing and seemed to have sexual overtones to her, which I think relates right back to the confusion between the miracle impulse and the sexual impulse, that the two are easy to confuse. She recognizes this, that she's misperceiving, and kind of snaps out of it. And in the morning, Jesus pats her on the back and says he's very pleased at the comparative lack of fear. This is T2B56 now. And also the concomitant awareness that it was a misperception. So she was thinking Jesus was making sexual advances to her in his expression of love in her revelatory experience. And initially she was alarmed and frightened, but recognized she was misperceiving the miracle impulse for the sexual impulse, if you will, and Jesus is patting her on the back for recognizing that misperception, which reflects a much increased right-mindedness, because defenses are now being used better on behalf of truth more than error. Now, that last paragraph is a bit, T2B59, it's a bit of a conundrum. Bill's remark concerning top of page 5, which is actually T2B60, the following paragraph, and it's interesting here that Helen is talking about a discussion she had with Bill about what comes next, which tells us there's a temporal sequencing issue here in this material, that it's been shuffled at some point. And once again, we have the theme of asking coming up in the last sentence. Note that Bill did not ask my will regarding it. If he had, he would have felt much better. So Bill had some kind of problem. We don't really know what it was. We can understand why this material got edited. But it's also kind of interesting in terms of practical application, and in terms of the potential value to all of us, that once again we have this, some kind of problem develops in Bill's experience, and Jesus' explanation is, he didn't ask me. And if he had, he would have felt much better. So, this brings us to the end of that section, and we come up to a really short little summary about defense disruptions and disorientation, which with 12 minutes we have time to read that, Deborah. I don't see any hands up, so I'm going to give you back the mic for T2B60.
Okay, there you go. Oh, I just lost. Slipped off my chair here. T2B60, defense disruptions and disorientation. You know that when defenses are disrupted, there is a period of real disorientation, accompanied by fear, guilt, and usually vacillations between anxiety and depression. This process is different only in that defenses are not being disrupted, but reinterpreted. even though it may be experienced as the same thing. In the reinterpretation of defenses, they are not disrupted, but their use for attack is lost. Since this means they can be used only one way, they become much stronger and much more dependable. They no longer oppose the atonement, but greatly facilitate it. The atonement can only be accepted within you. You have perceived it largely as external thus far, and that is why your experience of it has been minimal. You have been shown the chalice many times, but have not accepted it for yourself. Your major improper use of defenses is now largely limited to externalization. Do not fail to appreciate your own remarkable progress in this respect. You perceived it first as a vessel of some sort whose purpose was uncertain, but which might be a pisspot. I love Jesus' street mouth. You did notice, however, that the inside was gold, while the outside, though shiny, was silver. This was a recognition of the fact that the inner part is more precious than the outer side, even though both are resplendent, though with different value. Doug.
Well, this brings back the chalice mystery, which those of you who were with us in the early part of chapter one, the word comes up several times. And the chalice, the Holy Grail, perhaps, a vessel. And I think this refers to a visionary experience Helen had, which is sort of being described here. When it says, you did notice that the inside was gold, you perceived it first as a vessel of some sort whose purpose was uncertain, but which might be a pisspot. And the significance here is that you have been shown the chalice many times but have not accepted it for yourself. Now, what exactly is she being shown? What does this chalice symbolize? And it seems to me that it symbolizes the vessel that carries the atonement, the undoing, and thus the release and salvation. And you have perceived it largely as internal thus far, which is why your experience has been minimal. You have been shown the chalice many times, but have not accepted it for yourself, in quotes. Your major improper use of defenses is now limited to externalization. Do not fail to appreciate your own remarkable progress in this respect. You can again see why this was edited. It either needs expansion so that we know exactly what's being talked about. But I think the issue of external versus internal is relevant, that Helen can understand the atonement is something to apply to external things. She's getting actually pretty good at forgiving others, but she has trouble forgiving herself or applying it to internal things, that the miracle, the healing, the atonement actually apply to her as well as everybody else. And Carmen writes, the vessel in Kabbalah, perhaps, I'm not sure what, I don't know enough about Kabbalistic symbology to know what the vessel in Kabbalah means. Anyways, we're getting very close to the end here, so I'm going to ask first if anybody has any questions or comments they want to make. There's time here. Raise your hand. And we'll hand you the mic. We don't have time to even start on the next section, so that's where we're going to pick up next week, T2B 63, The Altar of God. And yeah, Carmen, if you want to comment on chalice vessels, by all means, do so. I would really like to hear what you have to say on it, if you wish to say anything. Okay.
Hello, can everybody hear me? My first challenge is to be heard. Yay! Okay. Thank you. Hi, guys. Oh, my God, I'm so sorry that I wasn't able to see hear the whole thing, but everything's in divine order. Because our group here has spent quite a bit of time on the Chalice of Atonement because it's such a beautiful image. And one of the things I'd like to point out, first of all, is the words gold and silver, which really bring up such a beautiful image for us, but also appeal to that part of us that assigns value to physical things, comes up only twice in the Course. Isn't that beautiful? And there's this, and then there's a reference that I called up on the document here. It's count then the silver miracles and golden dreams of happiness as all the treasure you would keep within the storehouse of the world. And I just love that. And Jesus is talking about the chalice being silver on the outside. Silver miracles of healing everything in our environment, and the golden dreams of happiness, the gold on the inside of the chalice being how we are inside, how we are inside determines how we relate to everything around us or that seems to be outside of us. So that's one of the reasons, one of the things that came up for us in our talk was looking up that the words gold and silver because they're used so rarely. I think golden is used in another place, but gold and silver together are only used in those two places in the Course. And I don't think there are any accidents in the Course in Miracles. So so there's this little hidden Easter egg, if you will, from the Ur-text into the body of the Course that made it out there. Anyway, when I reference the Kabbalah, they have this beautiful explanation of creation that, to me, you know, kind of reverberates and resonates with a lot of this creation analogy that's going on in the Ur-text. And one of them is this concept that God was happy and had everything, and he had the thought, how do you increase your joy? And the thought was, you share it. And so he created with that thought the vessel, another being that he could share his love and his joy with. And this vessel came into being specifically to be a receptacle for that love. And the vessel, through a nice little story, shatters because the love of God is more than it can contain. And, you know, that takes into consideration human ideas of limitation and degrees and all of that other kind of stuff. But it leads to this idea that the vessel, the Christ, it's another way of describing the Christ, shatters into billions and billions of pieces. And here we get back to this holographic vision of the Son of God that's presented over and over again throughout the Course about the pieces of the Son of God coming back together. And in Kabbalah, that is every individual person's job while here, is to be an active part of the coming back together of the shattered pieces of the vessel. And it's your brother and yourself are aspects of this vessel. And it's about getting rid of everything that divides you in your lifetime and bringing the vessel back together, two pieces at a time. And that concept is often referred to in the Hebrew as tikkun olam. And that almost literally translates into English as bringing back the creation as God intended it, or restoring creation as God intended it. And so this chalice of the atonement to me, it just overlaps with this image of the vessel from the Kabbalah so perfectly that I don't think it could possibly be a coincidence. And just understand, if you have any friends who are Jewish and they are studying A Course in Miracles, when they hear Chalice of Atonement, especially in the context of this part of the Ur-text, they're probably going to get that image too. Anyway, thank you, Doug and Deborah, for the time, and thank you, everybody, for being here. And I'm going to drop off so you guys can finish up. I love you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carmen. That's very helpful. to the other Deborah's question, very briefly, about what's meant by defenses being disrupted by the lessons in right-mindedness. Back in chapter 1, early, the word uprooting and disequilibrium, both those words occur frequently, as Jesus describes how unlearning things you believe will create a disequilibrium or a sense of disruption, because everything you thought was true is suddenly untrue and you feel dizzy almost. I think that's what the disorientation is referring to there. I think it's basically a reference back to that. But we are out of time here. So thank you, everyone, for your presence and your participation. As always, it's been a delight to share these 2 hours with you. And I'll hand the mic to Deb for her closing remarks.
Hey, I saw you posting, Dove, so thanks again for this room and the service that you're providing, Dove. Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone, for attending in-room and radio audience. And I love you all forever. See you next week, same time, 4 to 6 p.m. Bye.